The Lab takes the ethereal to the practical. Our podcast acts like a business school case study for private equity professionals, CEOs, operating partners, and chief transformational officers. We all know transformation is the key to differentiated alpha. Here's how you actually do it. Our audience tunes in to learn from those in the field, getting their fingernails dirty and driving meaningful growth through better operations, technology, and data. We learn from going to business school, teaching at business schools, and applying these lessons in the real world that case studies actually help the insight stick better. Come join us.
Welcome to the next episode of the Lab Podcast. We're here with Nick, as always, and our guest this week is Mark Tarchetti. He and I met originally when he was at Newell Brands, very senior executive there, and helping them think through the best way to grow a large variety of brands held within that conglomerate. We've worked a lot in the past about what maybe is more difficult within the world of M&A is driving value through growth. Everyone talks about M&A, everyone talks about integration, maybe not as much as they should, but they do. But Mark's had a great history of driving real differentiated alpha through growth of actual brands. And so, you know, Mark, it's great to have you on the podcast. Maybe what we'll do is let you give a quick background and then we'll dip into some questions.
Great. Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on. Much appreciated. So yeah, I've got an unusual background. I do something very few people do, which is business strategy. And I do it on the operational side. So there's lots of consultants, there's lots of academics around strategy, but there's very few practitioners. I cut my teeth 20 years in large cap corporations. So I joined Unilever right out of college. I grew up with an unemployed dad, so I've got no business school pedigree. I was the first person in my family to work in a large corporation. And I worked my way up to global head of strategy and worked for 3 years for the first ever outside CEO. So I kind of learned by doing background in finance, so understanding what fits businesses together. And then I went from that to 7 years with Knorr Rubbermaid, then Knorr Brands, where I ran the growth functions and was ultimately president of the company. And then 4 years ago, I decided to do something entrepreneurial and become an advisor and investor in growth brands. So set up a firm called Alchemy RX, working with 15 of the best people I've worked with over the last 20 years. And all we do is growth. We help, whether it's private equity firms on a deal or one of their portfolio companies, whether it's large cap multinationals, or whether it's founder-led growth brands. We help people design and deliver growth strategy. And that's all we do. We don't do cost savings. We don't do efficiencies. We don't do ways of working. It's all about operationalizing growth. And very, very few people do that. And I've had the privilege in the last 20 years to work on more than a couple of hundred brands. So a real breadth of experience in categories, industries, which kind of keeps a reinforcing loop of learning around different situations, different dynamics. And that's what got me here. And it's an exciting time to be working on organic growth.
Yeah, and I think to that point, I mean, one of the things that we're always, this podcast is about taking the ethereal to the practical. And so, you know, love to dip into just a quick case study or two that you think makes sense where you're bringing a fresh perspective from conviction of what you could do with an opportunity to actually how to make it happen, because it's easy to talk about it. It's hard to actually do it. And that's one of the things that I've enjoyed seeing from you in action.
So I'll give a great example from the last 12 months. We were very privileged to work on the Tropicana deal between PAI and Pepsi. And I think PAI were very smart. They hired a firm to do diligence, and they hired a firm to do the definition of the potential of the business. And that was our gig. And obviously, it was a relatively turnaround situation. The juice market's been in decline. It had been a low priority for Pepsi. Great set of brands, but had had a lot of cost work done and really not been managed for its full potential. So the question was, what could you do? But more importantly, how do I get that definitive, specific enough, tangible enough, quantified enough to get through co-investors, to get through investment committees, to get through lenders? And that was the role we ended up playing. And the way we do that is a few things. So I always liken growth to a supply chain. I found it very odd in my career that the way people manage cost and supply chains is very different to the way they manage growth. So in the value chain, if it's about cost or supply chain, you measure everything, inputs, outputs, processes, you're constantly improving them, and everybody has a number to hit, whether that's an efficiency improvement, whether that's a cost-saving number. In growth, it suddenly goes fuzzy and it becomes very top-down and management becomes very thematic. So you get shown a couple of innovations, but you don't get told what they're worth or how incremental they are. You get shown advertising, but you don't get told what it's going to do to sales or whether the consumer even likes that advertising. And you kind of get distracted with pop-up stores or the latest exhibition or event. And so people are much less definitive there. And we take the opposite approach, which is to say, fundamentally, you're trying to not just drive sales, you're trying to change customer and consumer behavior. And you can measure those. You can measure them with research, you can measure them in market data, you can measure them continuously, and you can measure them on a project basis. And so when it came to Tropicana, you know, we were lucky. Pepsi had years and years of research. The management team had years and years of institutional knowledge. But the new ask was very different. So we went through our usual strategy ideation process, looking at what mattered in the category, what the brands were capable of doing. We ideated new things to do. And then we used the research to validate them. We used market data to quantify them. And through that process, we get to what we call a kind of an activity-based financial model. So squirts into the sponsor's deal, just like every other input. But you can go initiative by initiative. This is what happens if we do nothing, the linear diligence view of the world, and then add back activities one by one. And we even use a media buyer to cost those things. So you've got not just the benefit, but the cost of changing consumer behavior. And it's all grounded in customer analytics. You know, what's a point of distribution worth in Walmart or a convenience store? And so through that process, which we were able to do in a matter of weeks, you get a tangible business plan. You choose how much you put in your business case to manage risk. You sequence it. You don't do it all at once. You may make the first wave the easiest, so it funds the second wave. But you get a business plan that, you know, I was very proud to present to the lenders, the co-investors, and it carried the majority of the value creation on the deal and was a real kind of positive alongside the traditional diligence product that other firms were delivering.
And one quick topic on that, you said, you know, it was speedy. It took weeks, not longer, like 1 or 2 weeks, which I've seen. And the numbers are quantifiable, right? Because that's it takes the squishy to the actual, to me. And the numbers are meaningful. These aren't sort of rounding errors. These are real important parts of that growth trajectory.
Yeah, what we usually find is people kind of just move the numbers to what they need them to be. And they, again, they then have some themes as to why that would be possible. We do the opposite, which is, what's going to happen if we do nothing, carrying on the business trends? Obviously, big dialogue around COVID spikes and so forth. And so you had to work that through. And then one by one, specific activities. And we then reviewed them with management. And management said, hey, that one's got some challenges. That one's got some technical issues. And you revisit it until you've got risk-adjusted, plausible plan. And the beauty is not just that you can see the value you might otherwise have missed. Day one, management's clear what are the things that are going to drive some of that incremental value and could start shifting resources, asking for the people they need, the projects they need to get after executing that. So it's very practical. It's very specific. Mm-hmm. And those financials, fairness opinions was done on them. So you treat it like any other input. But we've not yet met a sponsor that has that level of input to their business cases. And we think it's a pretty differentiated product.
Out of curiosity, when you're coming in as a outside strategist, how is it connecting with the management teams? Not the sponsors, so to speak, but I mean, you're coming on site and you're essentially saying, you're pretty forthcoming that a lot of these companies don't have a strategy, right? And you're helping build it. What's that like?
It's luckily not my first rodeo. I've worked on $40 billion of M&A transactions as in a hands-on role, either as the principal or as a key advisor. So I'm used to the management meeting forums and so on. And what we do is we're very transparent. You know, smoke and mirrors doesn't help. The kind of trying to hide what you're thinking, we go the opposite. I'm a plain speaking, open. What about this? When did you last try that? What's holding that back? Why is the competition focused here and we're not? And honestly, the reason we know we're onto incremental value is in auctions, I can tell when management haven't been asked those questions before because they're looking around for some data or some evidence or passing it between each other to answer. And then you really know you're onto something, but you need that customer consumer market data and practical plan to get confident there's a real idea there. And then we keep sharing it with management. You know, it's get their intuition, get their views. And I think on, you know, we're obviously talking principally to a private equity audience. the things that stop people acting on this in public companies are those crazy runs for the quarter, the focus on short-term metrics, constant management changes. The sponsor model is perfect for what I'm describing because it's got a medium to long-term time horizon. It's prepared to invest. It wants to back management. And what I try to do is create the conditions where we ask the questions that management didn't have the permission to ask before, or look at the tactics they didn't have the budget for, so we can get tangible as to what would you do to turn this up, rather than it be a turnaround, which people are good at when it's cost engineering and fixing issues. We're the turn-up guys that say, what could we do that we're not doing, or we're not doing to full potential, and let's get management on board. So for the team that's working on this, it's, I think, very exciting because it's the first sign of commitment from the sponsor. It's the willingness to pursue a business development strategy rather than simply an efficiency strategy. That doesn't mean, by the way, that you don't pursue the efficiencies. The clearer you are on the strategy, the clearer you are on what doesn't matter. And that's where your savings come from. But what you don't do is pull the savings out of the things that really matter to the brand and the customer. And so the clearer you are on strategy, the better.
Yeah. And to Scott's point, we're always talking about the public markets, 90-day sprints. The private, you have the luxury of not having that, right? Like you have a bit more freedom to operate and actually launch that strategic plan. One thing I do want to just hit on before we jump ahead to kind of modeling the full potential, and you already touched on a little bit, but I think it's really worth double tapping, is the diligence. You diligence potential as much as performance.
Yeah.
And this is that. That's a big distinguisher for you guys.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been through diligence. I've been through quality of earnings. I've done all that M&A I described. And you have to have that. You have to know what you're buying. You have to pressure test it. You have to look at a lot of moving pieces at the moment with COVID and all the craziness that's been in the world the last few years and commodities and so forth. So that's essential. There's no substitute for that. But having a second pair of eyes looking at something totally different, which is the potential of a brand, that's what strategy should all be about. It shouldn't be linear past performance. It shouldn't be constrained by what you did before. It should explore what's possible. And every time we do this, we find really tangible, really specific examples. And many of them already exist, by the way. They aren't all novel ideas. A lot of success in strategy comes from how decisively you execute. I was lucky at Knoll Brands, for example, to take on e-commerce when we had five people working on it, and I built it up to a $2 billion P&L. The idea of e-commerce wasn't remotely unique or differentiated. We just moved faster, we moved earlier, we moved more decisively, and we did it every quarter, every 6 months. We kept investing, kept sharpening our plans. And so you've really got to kind of not see all of this as difficult as it might sound, because not every idea has to be new, but the execution has to be bigger and better. And the best plans are where you've got some stuff in the drawer that can be better quickly, because that funds some of the more difficult, some of the bolder ideas that might be really transformative in value, but might not come till year two or year three, because they need some true R&D, some true engineering and product development work, or they need to really shift consumer behavior. And no sponsor wants a business plan that's got just the Hail Marys. You need the blocking and tackling, you need the easy moves. And so decisive execution is a game changer, but that's usually what you can uncover in diligence. And the linear approach just carries on the same. And the worst thing in my experience is when the CEO inherits that linear brief. And then they're basically incented to carry on as they were. Nobody's even thinking about what's possible. And so I think this is super important for incremental value. And it's the best way to manage risk, because right now, what are we all worried about? We're worried about changing consumer behaviors. We're worried about the rotation in retail. We're worried about the volatility from COVID and the aftermath of COVID. If you're focused on growth, it forces you to tackle obsolescence. It forces you to be on trend. It forces you to see those up-and-coming competitors and match them or beat them. And so to me, the future-proofing you get with this growth strategy is actually some of the best risk management in the kinds of environments business has been working through the last few years.
Yeah, I think, Mark, one of the things that, you know, we've talked about and we've seen this being implemented is activity-based management is the term that, you know, we've talked about a fair amount. And so, you know, you've spent a lot of time in consumer goods where, you know, category dynamics are important, margins are, you know, thin and can vary. And what you hit on just now, which was how do you use activity-based management? But, you know, Project One can feed more than feed and fund Project Two. We saw that with, this is one super small example with the glue and the slime and, you know, being thoughtful about, you know, how that was a beast of a return for you guys, let alone the more thoughtful and systematic approach at Tropicana. So, you know, love to sort of dig into that activity-based management and a thought process.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, it's the opposite of thematic management, Scott. So what I found in almost every brand I've worked on is the P&L, cost, supply chain, operating metrics side, it's all facts, it's all targets. Sometimes they're hockey sticks and unrealistic. There's always numbers for everything. When it gets to growth, it gets all fuzzy. Sometimes maybe people will give you a customer cut. They'll show you a few projects, but they won't tell you those projects are less than 2% of revenue. They'll just show you them as an excitement. And so what people don't seem to do around growth is distill things into very specific tactics. And then when they talk at this thematic level, everybody's pulling the same levers. Everybody's going for innovation. Everybody's going for e-commerce. Everybody's going for international expansion. So the way to differentiate is in the quality of your execution. And that means you need to manage the activity systems around something like innovation. So let me give you an example from my operating experience on innovation. So I was, you know, lucky to be responsible for innovation across a $16 billion company, but unfortunate to have 500,000 SKUs to do that on. So when you start setting benchmarks of 20, 30% of sales as should be innovated every 2-3 years, that's an awful lot of activity. And when you start that job, nobody can even tell you what projects are. Nobody can tell you what the budgets are. And so what we implemented was a set of processes. So firstly, we tracked ideas and we tested every idea with the consumer. So over the course of a few years, I think we tested 4,000 or 5,000 ideas with the consumer. So we could say, does the consumer perceive those innovation ideas as relevant and unique? Are they right for the category, relevant, and are they unique, i.e. there's something innovative and different about them? And you could compare that to all consumer innovation. So you could see whether it's average, whether it's better than average. And most people don't bother testing their ideas. And those ideas can be tested in a matter of days. It costs you a few $1,000s. So imagine launching something with a TV commercial that you haven't even spent a few thousand to check whether it's right. And it can be done super quickly. Then once you've got that, you can start quantifying them based on your category analytics and so forth. And you can look at things like failure rates as you develop projects. So you can start to say, how many innovations have I got? How much value are they likely to deliver? And how does that compare to my growth target? And if it's short, you need more ideas. And then as you manage that, every quarter I could see a report on the flow of ideas, the quality of them, which businesses were ahead, which were behind. I could see the winners, the best ideas, and I could put them on TV. I could spend my marketing budget on them. But it was all fact-based. And then in the process, guess what happened? We got better and better. Just like in a supply chain, when the guys on the line get asked for efficiencies every year, they figure out where can we get process bottlenecks sorted? How can we use our knowledge to go a little better? So with innovation, every year we got better. We got more projects, we got faster, we got bigger impact. But it all comes from focusing on the activity systems, from ideas to quality of ideas to flow through the funnel and measuring it. And that's what I see very, very few people doing. But that's the genesis of activity-based management. Do the same thing on e-commerce, do the same thing on international expansion, do the same thing on building brand equity. And that's when you start to differentiate yourself. I'm obviously a consumer goods guy, so I'm not talking to people in the oil and gas industry. It's products you buy in Walmart or on Amazon. But that's the kind of business model everybody shares. The question is, who can be better at it? And that's a matter of consistency, measurement, and continuous improvement. And I just don't see people doing that in growth. And that's what leaves so much opportunity on the ground, because so many brands are effectively maintained as they were, as cash cows.
And if there's an environment that encourages that, lovely, right? Because it's your job as the guy on top is to sort of make sure everything's working and proceeding as you would hope. How do you get people to sort of change their view? Because like sometimes you're in a consumer brand that is good on basing their value on historic wins. You sometimes have to change the mindset to be innovative. So how do you encourage that through the second and third and fourth layer down into a team?
What we do is shine a light on what's really happening. Most people are so busy running and gunning. And for sure, the last couple of years have been some of the toughest in business that I think any of us can remember, with, you know, one crisis after another. So giving people the chance to step back and creating an environment for them to see where they really are opens up new thinking. And if you start that discussion around potential rather than the P&L, the budget, what happened last year, you begin to get some energy. But the tools we use are really simple. So I use lockdown to write a book. It's called Pick a Lane. It's on growth strategy. And I put one very simple framework in there, which is a simple grid that every brand can plot their activity on. And one dimension is the consumer. And whether you're having minimal consumer impact, so that would be a different flavor of stock cube or a different variant of a hair shampoo. A medium impact where you're changing behavior a bit. So this is a new format. This is a new way of consuming that product. It's better, but it's different. You're trading up. You're paying some more money for the better version of that product. And then the third is disruptive. So you've got a sort of continuum from almost no change, just flavors. And that's where a lot of activity happens, colors, designs, through to medium. I'm changing some of my behavior through to breakthrough. And on the other axis, we plot customers. So which channels are big today and growing? Which channels are big today and declining because there's a big retail rotation? And which channels are growing fast, but we're not really present? And if you put your business on that matrix, it jumps out the page at you as to where you are. It shows you, wow, I'm not even present in these big growing customers. I really undertrade in club. I really undertrade in e-commerce. I don't have a D2C platform that's really big in this category. You benchmark all of that. And then your innovation, I can tell you most of it tends to be renovation that's making very little difference that the consumer doesn't really see. So they don't want to pay for it. They don't change their behavior. They don't come back to your brand for it. And you need a balance of that. And so you can get the team to kind of reappraise where they are and realize how much effort they put into standing still. And then you start plotting the chips as to which moves we're going to make on both axes to get incremental value. And every time we do that, it gets tons of things that are in flight that could get more money. It gets tons of things that we've under-resourced that could be bigger if we just tried harder or focused on them. And then it designs the gap that says, hey, we've been run for profit for 5 years. We just need to go do some innovation work. And that will always start with knowledge of the consumer. So, you know, one of the things we do remorselessly is use consumer insights. It's very fashionable these days to say, don't use research. It's crazy. You need to know your consumer factually. And you ask them, what are you missing in this category? What are your unmet needs? What are the things you'd love this brand to do? And that's the source of innovation in the round. So sometimes people need a boot camp or two on that if they've been run for profit. But it's very practical. It can be done. You know, you can turn the tide on this in weeks if you get an energized team. And the team's always energized because they have a passion for their brand. They're coming to work every day. If you say, can we take it to the next level? They're like, hell yeah. We believe we can take it to the next level. We just need some help. And we need to come back with practical plans that somebody can invest in, because I can't just promise growth and not be able to explain the business case, not be able to explain the cost of it, not be able to get people confident it's realistic. And that's why this activity-based management and activity-based financial model is key, because that's how you get the same granularity of business case as you do with a cost-saving project.
Mark, we could talk about each of these little sub-bullets, I feel like, for 30 minutes, but, you know, we like to make them bite-sized. I do want to hear about the culture of growth and your perspective and history working with founders. It sounds like they have a lot of the ambition and vision that you're looking to help drive, correct?
Yeah, so I was lucky in my career to work with a lot of founders, and some of them trusted me to buy their business, which is probably the biggest compliment you can get in business, to be honest. And I learned a lot from them. And they were always very different to the corporate people I'd spent my life with. And as I thought about what I learned, it was really the fact that every single one of them, they were all very different. They had very different contexts, very different businesses, very different personalities. But they shared some traits that made them successful and were what I didn't find in corporate brands. So first off, they were always ambitious. There was never a kind of, could we stand still this year? Could we grow 1%? They were always shooting for the stars. Lots of different ways to define what that looked like, but they were always shooting big. And they were consistent about that. And they would sort of only really have the capacity to think of one or two ways to work towards it. So they'd know, this is the two things that matter. This is what we have to get better at, and we're shooting for the stars. And they then put huge consistency to that and huge willingness to learn and be agile and be humble in pursuit of those goals. So what I saw was these crazy learning curves. There's a story in my book about the Sistema founder who, when he started, he didn't know how to make any plastics. And the story of his first manufacturing experience is hilarious. When I bought Sistema from him, he had a world-class manufacturing facility. And it was a 25-year journey that took him from a nobody in plastics to one of the best manufacturers in the world with world-class equipment and a world-class team. But think of the humility, think of the growth curve, think of the vulnerability you have to embrace. And what gets you through that is the constant pursuit of the North Star, the goal, the passion, the belief that if we can get this right, our brand can take over the world. And so little of that is there in corporations because you get rewarded for internal performance. You focus on internal benchmarks and which job you get versus your peers. And there's just a lot of change. There's a lot of inconsistency because people move all the time. That's how you succeed. And so that consistency, that ambition, and that humility on a learning curve set the founders apart. And that's kind of why I started an advisor. It's like, I just want to work on lots of businesses and be out of my comfort zone rather than be in a contained corporate environment where I can know everybody and I can control the strategy and everything else. I want to do something more entrepreneurial, and it's been super fun.
Yeah, well, Mark, I think the clients that we know and work with together have certainly really valued the input and the fact that it's so tangible and quick. You don't get those all the time, so it's great to have gotten to know you over, it feels like a long time, but maybe it's only been a decade. I'm not really sure, but so far, so good. And super glad that you've joined us, Nick and I, on this podcast. And we're just fun to watch you continue to innovate and improve and drive value. It's great to also be able to invest in some of these opportunities that we're collectively working on. So philanthropy is great, but that's a weekend activity. It's nice to sort of work together. So thank you for joining us. We're very excited to share your thoughts of practical growth to the private community that we all work in, and lots more exciting things to go.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on, guys, and good luck with the podcast.
Hope you guys enjoyed that. Really nice talking to Mark. A little different flair this episode than the last two, huh? I mean, this guy transitioning from the big companies, now he's working with growth and focused with vision and working with founders. It's an interesting perspective. I liked it.
Yeah, it's helpful to get his perspective to your point on it seems easy to achieve your goals. It seems easy, but through M&A, right? That's fine. Five and five is 10. So if you can double EBITDA, that's great. Or 20 and 20 is 40, whatever it is. His point was about growth. And that one's a harder one to tackle. And what I've enjoyed working with him over the years and helping firms figure out how to grow and where to focus and how to have the spend that you save on the growth bleed into the next project. So you're not constantly funding things. The success that you have in growth funds the next opportunity. So the CapEx spend, which is, a dirty word for private equity firms, is minimized. It's really great.
Yeah. And in today's, we didn't really get to hammer home the macro right now in today's environment, but every firm I'm speaking with, they're really concerned about the next 12 months. And they're really concerned about, hey, we can't just keep piecing these things together. Valuations are all over the place. There's going to be a lot of dry powder on the sidelines, and you're going to be looking at management teams to grow these companies organically and cost effectively. And one of the big things that I really liked him talking about on the diligence side of the house is measuring the potential as much as the past performance of these companies. A strategist like him, he's got a very unique perspective, and I'm assuming more and more of our PE colleagues or folks that we work with are going to be using people like Mark, let's say, in the next 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to do. It's just because you did it right or successfully in the past doesn't guarantee you're going to have to be successful in the future. So you got to pivot and be thoughtful that way and not be overly playbooked about it. But you surely should also learn from successes and failure. So you're right. He's also just a nice guy. So it's nice that we're able to, you and I, connect with him. And hopefully, those that are listening pick up a little gem here or there, a little nugget here or there. And that's the point of this podcast.
Yep, that's the goal. We'll be back again with another high performer. Hope you guys enjoyed.